It's Wednesday, May 24th, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, President Trump's first overseas trip. We'll talk about the moments that everyone else has been talking about and one or two that only some folks picked up on, but maybe got drowned out with some of the other big news. We're going to remember Roger Ailes. His sudden death has people talking about what the real legacy is that he'll leave behind. And The Guardian got its hands on Facebook's internal training manuals for the people screening and blocking indecent content. We'll talk about what's in them and hopefully a whole lot more that we'll get to before our half hour is up. But let's start with something that, Mike, you had brought up quickly in passing last week about the DNC staffer who was murdered last summer. Last week, Fox News started reporting that there was evidence that Seth Rich had been in communication with WikiLeaks 12 days before his murder. Here's a clip from Fox News from May 16th.
A brand new bombshell in the murder of that guy right there, a DNC staffer. An investigator now says Seth Rich was in contact with WikiLeaks.
Not only that, he claims there's been a law enforcement cover-up.
Well, Griff Jenkins live in Washington with these breathtaking, breaking developments. Griff.
Brian Angeli and Steve, good morning. Breaking indeed and developing at a rapid pace. Bombshell new evidence of a former DNC staffer you just showed there, Seth Rich, suggests he was in communications with WikiLeaks prior to his murder last summer. Let me take you back. Here in the nation's capital, it was last July. DNC staffer Seth Rich was shot and killed on the way home from a bar in a trendy Northwest neighborhood here. Police initially saying that they believed it was a botched robbery, but questions remain with the investigation still open. Now, a year later, according to a parallel investigation by former D.C. police homicide detective and Fox News contributor Rod Wheeler, there's evidence that Rich had contact with WikiLeaks, that evidence on a laptop belonging to Seth Rich, showing he was talking with WikiLeaks. Wheeler says this smells like a cover-up.
I want to find out who caused that man's death so we can put them behind bars. But if there's somebody in politics, if there's somebody in government, whether it's in the mayor's office or anywhere else in this city that's involved, you better believe they're going to be dragged in and questioned.
That's some pretty breathless and hyperbolic reporting. And now Fox is backing off the story. How come?
Because almost none of that can be confirmed. A lot of it has been debunked. And Fox News, the people who are in charge of the actual news operation itself, decided that what Sean Hannity and other people were doing with this sort of loosely sourced story was really harmful to their network. So it's been a long time coming for them to retract this story, but they finally did the right thing.
Well, they've retracted the story, but that's not keeping the usual Sean Hannity
is still not ready to back down.
And then you had Newt Gingrich this Sunday morning talk shows. He brought it up. There's no information to back up or no facts to back up what they're putting out there. It's all partisan. It's all to divert the ongoing story about the Trump campaign's connection to the Russian hackers. And they were trying to use this story to sort of say, well, wait a minute, you know, there's this DNC person who was the one that was really giving WikiLeaks the information and not the Russians. Well, there's no information to make that connection. There never was any. And to my knowledge, this is one of the first times that Fox has actually backed off a story that is this politically explosive in a way that sort of helped them to create the narrative that was against what was actually out there with the facts.
The problem, of course, is that even though they've retracted the story, the damage has been done, mm-hmm. and the our hyper-partisan media, there are a lot of people who wanted to believe it. There were enough interesting pseudo circumstances involving this story, including the fact that the WikiLeaks founder was putting out a reward for who murdered Seth Rich. You had this person who allegedly worked for the Washington, D.C. Police Department, who is now a private investigator.
Yeah, let's talk about this guy for a second, this Rod Wheeler guy. Yeah. What is his story? How is he factoring into this, and who's paying him for this search he's supposedly doing?
Well, from what I've been able to tell, and Mike, you may have some additional information on this, this, it seems to me he's an investigator who's trying to make a name for himself in whatever way that he can. And he seized on this and knew that it would be something that Fox News and the right-wing media would jump onto. And yeah. I think that's where this is going.
The problem is, I mean, here's a gentleman who, whatever his background, and there's some question about what exactly he did for the Washington, D.C. Police Department, but whatever his background, he convinced the family at some point, the family of Seth Rich, to hire him as a private investigator because it was taking a long time and the D.C. police hadn't really come up with anything. But he was being paid, we're told, by a Fox News contributor and a prominent GOP fundraiser. And this guy himself is also a Fox News contributor. So how is it that he's working for the family's best interests and he's working for the best interests of conservative media at the same time?
And I also find it interesting that the family said that they are glad that Fox is not going to be running the story anymore, but they would not say whether or not Fox had apologized for the narrative that they've created that is now out there.
They didn't apologize. If you look at the, I mean, I don't know what they did privately, but publicly, in the statement they released, they did say they were withdrawing the story because it didn't meet their standards and they hadn't vetted it. But they also said that...
Well, when does that ever stop Fox News?
Well, there are some real journalists at Fox News. The problem is they said that they were going to continue looking into this and that if there was anything more, they would update the public. So it's basically like saying, we haven't really given up on this story yet and that we're hoping that we're going to get some information that will allow us to corroborate it. The latest piece of this that's really weird for me is this guy... Kim.com, who is an American businessman who's in New Zealand trying to avoid prosecution here for copyright infringement and other legal problems. There's some question about whether he has information. He claimed he had information that would corroborate this story, but then he decided he wasn't going to release it. And the Washington Post did a story saying he might have been actively trying to plant fake emails on the dead man's email account to try to make the case for it.
Okay, well... It was about 7:30 our time last Thursday morning when this happened.
Roger Ailes, one of the founders of the Fox News Channel, has died.
Wow.
And they have published, Drudge has, a statement from his wife, Elizabeth.
She says, "I am profoundly sad and heartbroken to report that my husband, Roger Ailes, passed away this morning. Roger was a loving husband to me, to his son, Zachary, and to... and a loyal friend to many.
He was also a patriot, profoundly grateful to live in a country that gave him so much opportunity to work hard, to rise, and to give back. During a career that stretched over more than five decades, his work in entertainment, in politics, in news, affected the lives of many millions. And so even as we mourn his death, we celebrate his life."
Beth, you are in our thoughts and our prayers.
Wow.
And so is Zachary, their beautiful son. Roger, rest in peace.
We now know that the cause of death was a fall and a blow to the head. But in those early moments, it was really unclear if it was natural or if there had been some other things going on there. I guess the first thing that surprised me was it was the Drudge Report who broke the story and perhaps not Fox News itself.
Well, I'm not sure that the family was completely, thrilled with the idea that Fox News let him go, even though they gave him, a multi-million-dollar settlement. But, he had a complicated life and a complicated influence on media. I mean, I think those expressions of support that you heard from people on Fox were heartfelt. And there were people, even within the news side of Fox, Shepard Smith, for example, who said some very positive things about Roger Ailes. At the same time, of course, we now know that he was allegedly sexually harassing female employees for years, and that led to his being ousted from Fox News. So this guy's leaving a very complex legacy, and it's not a simple headline that's going to tell us what happened.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It is complex. I mean, you know, for all of the problems that have and controversy that has come up that led to his firing, that led to all the other changes that have come about at Fox, and the ongoing mess that they're having to deal with sexual harassment and racial issues within the structure, he created a network that challenged the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. He created a network that basically knocked CNN off as the number one cable news outlet. And he also brought back, many historians would say, that he brought back partisan media in a way that mirrors what we saw in the early republic, but is different because it's actually owned by a conglomerate and not by a political party, even though it's connected to, quite heavily to a political party.
And I can say, you know, from when he did create Fox News, was there a need or was there at least a vacuum for someone to step in with a conservative point of view in news coverage? Absolutely. I mean, at the very least, there was a sort of a corporatist, centrist sort of view of the news that was taken by most major news organizations. And so for Fox to come in and have an alternative, nothing at all wrong with that. But sometimes the excesses of trying to cater to that audience are what kind of bit them. I mean, there was a piece, Monica Lewinsky wrote a piece in the New York Times this past week saying basically that she took, that he rather, Roger Ailes, took the affair that she had with Bill Clinton and basically turned it into the Fox News strategy for covering that kind of story. They even had a poll she mentioned one time on the air back in the days when they were first covering the story, said, is Monica Lewinsky an average girl or a young tramp looking for thrills? And that's the kind of sort of populist approach that Fox News took under Roger Ailes that you could see how it could appeal to that audience, but also was really problematic for some of our own journalistic traditions.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you're right in terms of what he built in that conservative, right-leaning type of news led to what we have now on the other side, which is MSNBC and it's left-leaning in that respect. What I do find interesting is that within the span of a year, you've had this almost total house cleaning of that kind of rhetoric on Fox News, especially in primetime.
Generation that created that rhetoric.
Right, right.
And the rhetoric itself on some
Exactly. I mean, all you have left now is Sean Hannity.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to find themselves. What is the next iteration of Fox going to be now that Roger Ailes is out? And they're still trying to figure that out. Meanwhile, their ratings are dropping, and there is some concern as to whether or not they're going to be able to maintain that lead.
It's also sadly ironic when a lot of people thought Ailes' ouster was going to do something about the corporate culture of sexual harassment, especially at Fox News, but not exclusively there. And now it looks like with his sudden death, it could have an impact on those lawsuits, and it might be more difficult to actually prove that the harassment took place for those people who've sued Fox News and Roger Ailes.
Okay, well, Fox News Channel, along with the other television networks, have spent much of their early morning programming with wall-to-wall coverage of President Trump's first overseas trip. The couple of days in Riyadh, followed by a stop in Israel, and now Rome. The tour of the holy sites for three of the world's dominant faiths. And there were definitely some moments that we will remember from the coverage of this trip. The speech with the leaders of more than 50 predominantly Muslim countries, urging them to join the U.S. in a lead to fight ISIS. The video of Donald Trump at the Western Wall, a landmark no other U.S. president has visited while in office. And the news conference that was held with Israeli leaders and with Palestinian leaders following the Manchester attacks. There were some quieter moments too, some that were not as well publicized, like this one on the tarmac at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport. It's kind of hard to hear over the engine noise, but that's Sarah Netanyahu, the wife of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, telling Melania Trump that they have a lot in common, that she and her husband are very popular with the Israeli people, but not so much with the Israeli press, and that that's something more that they can talk about at dinner. Let me ask you about some of the things that have stood out about this past week to you.
Well, I mean, I think that the Trump administration and Trump and his people have tried to stay on message, and by and large, they've done pretty well on that. That was the one thing that the media was really, or the news media, those who are with them and those who are watching from here, were really sort of concerned about. Is he going to stay on message? How is this going to look in terms of the president of the United States on his first foreign visit? Is he going to, how's he going to deal with the Muslim nations, that sort of thing? And by and large, he's been pretty much on message. Now, there was some some of the video that you see him with the sword and that sort of thing, that they played that over and over, and that kind of looks a little goofy. But
or Hot Eretz created a gif of him trying to reach for Melania's hand, and she slapped it away, and that becomes kind of a viral storyline.
Those kinds of things. But by and large, I mean, it's been pretty much what they wanted. What it hasn't done is it hasn't stopped what's happening here in terms of the ongoing story of what's happening in Trump's campaign and the connections to the Russian hacking. That has ramped up with every single hearing that you're having now on both the House and the Senate side.
And I have to say, I do think we are getting to the point where occasionally our brethren and sisters on cable news are going to extremes. I mean, even when the attack in Manchester first occurred and it started being reported by the BBC, by Reuters, by Fox News, CNN was still talking about Trump. MSNBC was still talking about Trump. It took them a lot longer than it should have to get onto that bigger story. And also, I think while he was there, you know, I mean, you can argue about the substance of what he said, but he did, I think, kind of keep on message at least, but there were a lot of media reports about process that we care about, but I'm not sure the public cares about, and I'm not sure how well it affected sort of the public's perception of the media. There was the talk, for example, you showed of the tape on the tarmac. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, Secretary of State Tillerson not letting U.S. reporters into a press conference with international reporters. There was the Commerce Secretary who was saying, hey, look, there are no protesters. Well, in Saudi Arabia, you couldn't protest or you'd be arrested. But that kind of stuff is so insider baseball, I'm not sure that it helped us in our trying to cover the Trump administration and get the public to understand what we're doing there.
Okay, well, it seemed like every intro that an anchor read that was run on TV since the trip began has ended with some reference to the baggage that the president has taken on the trip with him, referring, as you were just saying, Ernest, to the developments and the firing of James Comey, what Michael Flynn knew, and so on. Friday night, that was the topic on Anderson Cooper 360. Cooper had on pundit Jeffrey Lord, a Trump backer, or as some might call him, a Trump apologist. See what I mean?
I don't care what he says to the Russian Russians. He's the president of the United States. If he wants to say that, Barack Obama wants to say whatever. If George Bush says, I looked in his eyes.
If he took a dump on his desk, you would defend it.
Say it. What?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know what he would do that you would not defend. Anderson, I mean, you're a loyal guy. I think that speaks well of you, but I.
So you might have been able to tell Lord pretty much laughed it off, and Anderson Cooper caught himself soon after, and he realized what he had done. So he tweeted an apology, calling his joke crude and unprofessional. The reason this caught my eye, though, I mean, after a chuckle or two that it happened, we sat here last week and we talked about the eye roll heard all around the world, that when Kellyanne Conway said something, he kind of rolled his eyes as best he could. And a couple days later, Kellyanne Conway goes on Fox News and calls it a Trumpist behavior. Then Anderson Cooper turns around and does this. Is this snark getting out of control?
You know, I don't think so. Now, he had to apologize, right? As a journalist, he has to come across as being fair. But he and Jeffrey Lord are actually friends. And when Jeffrey Lord responded on Twitter, he didn't, you know, go all high and mighty, you know, and say that he was being Trumpist or whatever. He said, you know, message America, it's okay to laugh. We're friends on and off camera. Don't worry about it.
Yeah,
and maybe a little bit of levity would be okay.
But the audience doesn't know that they're friends,
well,
you know?
But Jeffrey Lord, you know, among all of the Trump people that they bring on CNN, he's the one person that stands out because he takes his message of defending Trump seriously, but he doesn't always take himself seriously. And there's a fair amount of this back and forth with him and Anderson Cooper. Frank, lighten up a little. That's okay by me.
Yeah, I mean, you could see it just, I mean, and if you've watched the two of them before on Anderson Cooper's show, you see this back and forth. And if you've watched enough, you'll see that they're friends. I don't know whether or not we should make that big of a deal out of this, but I do think that Anderson Cooper needs to be a little bit more careful about how he thinks about what he says about the president, his gestures toward guests when it comes to talking about the president, because it can show a pattern, and that could become a problem. Unless he's trying to go in that direction of a Sean Hannity or Don Lemon or someone
but,
like that.
See, one of the things that puts Anderson Cooper in a slightly unique and I realize you can't be slightly and unique, but in a unique situation is that he's also a correspondent for 60 Minutes. So his behavior doesn't only reflect on CNN and CNN's editorial and programming strategy, it does have an effect on CBS as well, doesn't it?
Well, it has an effect on CBS. Yeah. It also has an effect on CNN because he's the guy that they send out to cover the big news events. Mm-hmm. And if you're seen as being this way in your show and then expect the public to take you very seriously when a big event happens, that there could be some problems there. But that's all a part of what we talk about all the time about media literacy. But you have to remember some in the public aren't as literate as we would like them to be.
Mike's doing the sway in the chair thing. It shows that he doesn't really agree with that.
No, I mean, I think that what he did with Kellyanne Conway showed a lot more disrespect.
Oh, no, I agree with that totally.
You know, you could imagine an interviewer, whether it's him or anybody else, legitimately saying in an interview when Jeffrey Lord or any other politician was saying, you know, he could take it up on his desk and you'd still defend him. And we'd all laugh and say, you know, that might be a way to get an answer that the other approaches didn't get. A little bit of humor or levity is a kind of a good interviewing technique sometimes.
But if you watch that if you watch his show all the time when Jeffrey Lord is on there, you would see that kind of banter with him. Right. You don't see that with Kellyanne Conway. Right. So that's what made the whole eye roll even more pronounced than, say, what just happened in this interview.
Okay, so let's talk about an impromptu news conference that was held at the Ecuadorian embassy in London after word that the rape case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was dropped. But that doesn't mean that he's free. His self-imposed house arrest continues, since he could face arrest and charges here in the United States for publishing state secrets.
The UK refuses to confirm or deny at this stage whether a US extradition warrant is already in the UK territory. So that's the dialogue that we want to happen. Similarly with the United States, while there have been extremely threatening remarks made. I'm always happy to engage in a dialogue with the Department of Justice about what has occurred.
Okay, so what's the point of having that news conference on the embassy steps? Is it just a game of chicken with the United States government?
I want out of here. and I would really like to have a conversation with the Justice Department to see if we can negotiate something so I can get out of here.
It also shows that basically he's just trying to be a master of spin. He's not just this person who stands up for transparency at no cost, because he's trying to say, look, I won. I'm not guilty. And all the prosecutors were saying in Sweden was that, you know, the time limit for this case is going to run out before we can get a hold of him. And there's no sense in trying to pursue this any further. He's right to worry about the United States, though. Yes. And he's right to worry about the Brits.
If he walks out of there, they're going to grab him and extradite him to the United States quick, fast, and in a hurry.
And right. And so when he says, I want out of here, I've been here long enough, I want out of here, does he really have that much leverage with the United States to sit down in that meeting?
Not really. I don't think so.
No, and the Trump administration has a couple of additional cards. I mean, the Obama administration, the president wanted to bring him back here and try him as well. But President Trump now has this whole business about the collusion with the Russians. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a different part of this. It's not just like, well, he leaked documents. Journalists take documents and put them out there all the time. But if Trump wanted to try to take a little pressure off this Russia investigation by going after Assange for assisting in that, that could be really interesting.
Okay, well, Sunday afternoon, I was sitting on my couch thinking about taking a nap and saw something go by in one of my social media feeds that I couldn't pass up. Little did I know I'd spend the next hour or so reading it. The Guardian got its hands on Facebook's internal manuals given to moderators who screen content for sex, violence, and hate speech. What resulted was a 10-part series, including PDFs of PowerPoint presentations outlining what the social platform considers to be out of bounds, when nudity is okay, when it's not, what constitutes a threat, what doesn't, what's hate speech, and what's not. Some of the criteria here seem kind of arbitrary.
Well, you know, I will say this much again, and I don't defend Facebook all the time, but they at least had a process. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem was it was a process that wasn't made public, and it's a process that's made difficult to carry out because of just the sheer volume of stuff that they have to check. And, you know, we could agree or disagree on their standards on whether you should show images of child abuse or whether you should allow language that appears to be generically threatening but not targeting an individual. There's a lot of stuff like that that we can argue about. But they had a series of policies. They could defend their policies. They used as part of training their staff. But they've got like 4,000, 5,000 people or whatever out there trying.
And they're supposed to be hiring another 3,000.
Yeah, but they've got 2 billion users. And sometimes they were saying in the Guardian story that they might be able to spend 10 seconds looking at a complaint and then deciding whether it should be, you know, knocked out of the stream or not knocked out. And that's just too much volume to deal with.
Well, you know, when I saw this, when you sent this to us, I was really surprised by the fact that this hadn't got out earlier. I mean, they've had this manual and they've used it for a while and updated it on several occasions and changed some things and that sort of thing. But this is the first time we've actually been able to see the entire thing. So that sort of surprised me. I agree with you in the fact that they have training, they have all these things, but they're really not spending enough time with it. And there's no rhyme or reason as to when they use it and when they don't. So I think that's problematic.
I guess I don't know that I would agree that there's no rhyme or reason, but
they aren't spending enough time.
They're not transparent about it either.
Thank you.
So there is something we wanted to talk about last week that we didn't get a chance to. And with only about 2-3 minutes left in today's show, I want to make sure we talk about it this week. Something that appears to be a trend, especially at a time when we're calling for more media literacy, 3 news and information products that are being created for and targeting children. In some ways, I've almost been talking to people about this and kind of calling it the Joe Camel campaign. Try to hook them while they're young with products from the New York Times, from NPR, and a very successful one down in Australia.
And, you know, this has been going on for a long time in the media, newspapers, in the classroom, and all this kind of stuff. But it is interesting. There's one in Australia called Crinkling News, the New York Times, as a supplement for young people. But do young people really want to read the printed page? I don't know. The NPR one called, you know, it's called Wow in the World. It's a podcast, and it has hosts who really target kids with their language, with their approach to stories. It's about science and discovery. That's a really interesting podcast. I've listened to a couple of episodes, and I think they could succeed.
I think that one is going to be successful because of the way in which they do it. I think the mistakes are being made is that you're trying to reach a generation that thinks visually. Mm-hmm. And if you're really going to do this, you're going to have to figure out a way to get them into these stories from a visual nature. Having kids tell their stories to other kids, doing it that way.
Which is kind of a throwback. If you'll remember, Linda Ellerbe had a news program that was on Nickelodeon for a long time that she produced with children.
Right. That's the kind of thing I think that's going to get them in. And if you can do it creatively and bringing in that information, that might work. But I'm with Mike. Having them try to read something on a screen, I don't think that's going to get it done.
You know, I would mention really briefly, and we'll talk about it some later time on the show, but we have a new fellow coming on at RJI. It's basically the Cedar Rapids newspaper. Okay. They're going to try to gamify media literacy for young people, and that might be an interesting approach to take.
Yeah. Okay, well, we are just about out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all of the topics that we talked about on our program today, and a couple of others we still didn't have time for. They're all on our links blog, which is under the programs tab at kbia.org. We also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. We'll be off next week, but invite you to keep the conversation going with us online. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Kyle Felling for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.